Okay,
we're on the same plane anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they
stayed
at the exact same spot the whole time. They're not
colored,
like you say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
Marty,
are you ready for this?
But what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
Sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I'd
thrown it. For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that it tastes like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Yes, these are Strange Days Indeed, and this program reflects the UFO side of this strangeness. Welcome to program number 381 in the current series. 381 weekends. That's almost as long as I've been around. Tonight, Dave Furlott with his take on things. Cryptozoologist Lorne Coleman, who's written a new book along with Jerome Clark. And investigator of UFOs over nuclear missile sites, Robert L. Hastings. We talked about Robert Hastings last week, gave you a couple of clues to go look at some of the stuff that he has uncovered. If you print it out, it's 23 pages of witness testimony in about 8 or 9 point. Quite an amazing amount of stuff at the NICAP website. You can get to it via tonight's program listings. It says UFOs and nukes if you'd like to go and take a look at those before Robert comes on after the news at the top of the hour. Email here from Robert. Hi, Errol. Wonder if the local MUFON, Mutual and UFO Network, knows this and has already told you. But after a hiatus of around 13 years or so, the Mutual UFO Network Ham Radio Net hopes to be on the air this coming Sunday, which is tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Standard Time. And if you have a pen handy or you can remember this frequency, it's 7.238 megahertz in the 40-meter amateur radio band. No, there are a lot of hams out there that listen to this program. So let me repeat that. That's tomorrow at 12 noon at 7.238 megahertz in the 40-meter amateur radio band. You probably need, if you have a shortwave receiver, you'll need one that's capable of reception of SSB single sideband audio transmissions. As it was back in 91 to 93. This is actually interesting that MUFON's ham radio network is coming back together again. This info was emailed to Robert by Leslie Varnacle in Denver, Colorado, just after a friend in Nebraska mentioned the intention of the network to reform. And Robert says, as a shortwave listener and longtime UFO enthusiast, basically since 1947, and a former NICAP and MUFON member, he listened to that net while it flourished and got to recognize many hams from all across the USA and a few from Canada by their voices, and had spoken to a couple by telephone and recommended books to them that were available only in Canada from the world's biggest bookstore. Later, we continued contact by email, since I don't have a ham license, even though I'm a professional. Yeah, anyway, now long retired. Hope this reaches you before it's too late. Yes, Robert, it's far too late. That's tomorrow, 12 noon, 7.238 megahertz for the Mutual UFO Network's ham radio gathering. an interesting and an unexpected in this day and age of email and cameras on top of your machines and instant images and them phones with TV built in and those strange beavers on television. Yes, I'm going to the room next door to call pest control. Let's see here. Brad Creek, Alberta. At around 2 a.m. on January 30th, a couple of friends were awakened by a low humming noise and clattering against all the windows of a country home. Sounds like something like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, doesn't it? So they looked outside and saw 20-plus tiny blue lights in the sky, so picked up a video camera and began shooting. The objects were very high up, flying in numerous directions, or they hovered together one on top of the other for about an hour. The objects got larger, and as they slowly descended to the ground, they took close-ups on video. A ridge a mile and a half to the north began to emit a daylight-like glow. Only a few objects were visible when the humming sound became almost deafening. And suddenly the wind began to rip at the house. The lights pulsated, and clouds of smoke rose up slowly from six of those lights in the distance. When the reporting witness picked up the phone, there was only a buzzing sound. They leant out of the window and heard the most eerie howl, a siren, then a blood-curdling deep scream. Suddenly, a strong breeze came from the north that smelled like burning plastic. The sensor light outside the house kept coming on and going off, and they heard crashing and banging against the house, scratching through the walls on every side. They thought they saw a very pale, tall figure with glowing eyes run across the driveway. Petrified, they shut themselves inside the house, and then saw smoke puff up from the lit-up hilltops again, and tiny blue lights shot up quickly from the hillside into an instant hover. The lights got smaller as they flew higher, but remained visible for a long time. Our thanks to the witness and to Brian Vike of HBCCUFO.com for that report. A couple of other reports from Ontario, perhaps we'll get to those a little later, but right now, Dave Furlot will join us.
Here with his take on it is Dave Furlot.
There's been a little bit of what I like to call feather ruffling in the UFO community lately, because Kevin Randall was doing a little investigating and digging concerning the credentials of one of the witnesses that Stephen Greer brought forth for his disclosure effort. The thread is on the UFO updates list, labeled now as Lovkin is a General But. It concerns Stephen Lovkin being presented as Brigadier General Lovkin by Stephen Greer as part of his disclosure effort. Now think for a moment. If someone from the military comes forward and makes claims about what they have seen or heard or been part of concerning UFOs, that information has a certain amount of weight. When someone comes forth who is of superior rank, general or above, that information has even more weight. The generals and admirals are the decision makers. They are the ones that speak on a regular basis to the politicians. In many cases, they have to play the political game themselves, because their rank is not merely awarded to them based on the years of service, but due to their accomplishments and their willingness to do things in the Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marine way. So when Stephen Greer brought forward Brigadier General Stephen Lovkin, and we heard his testimony about what he learned while he was a duty officer in the White House, everybody took notice real fast. But one thing that has to be done whenever anybody makes claims about things involving UFOs and aliens is they have to be vetted. In other words, the person, their claims, and their background needs to be checked to ensure that what they're saying is something more than just a story they're making up. There have been many people claiming to be part of the military, even though they have never served a day in uniform.
even in the military, there are people who make claims that they were ranks higher than they really were, or they were part of some elite group like the Navy SEALs of the United States. The sad reality is they may have wanted that, but unfortunately they were never able to accomplish it. Now, Kevin Randall set out to get proof that Brigadier General Stephen Lufkin was exactly what he and Stephen Greer claimed that he was, a Brigadier General, and basically could find no proof that Stephen Lufkin was a Brigadier General in the U.S. forces and made his findings public. This caused Stephen Greer to launch an attack against Kevin Randall, claiming that he had not bothered to check anything and that he was guilty of libel and slander against Brigadier General Lufkin. Greer even posted pictures, letters, and other proof that Stephen Lufkin was in the military and associated with the White House, as Stephen Lufkin claimed that he was. But at first examination of the Greer evidence, you will see that the rank being shown is that of a sergeant, and the letters refer to Specialist Lufkin, an enlisted rank, not that of an officer. Now, this is where it gets a little muddy. Brigadier General Lufkin did hold the rank of Brigadier General, but he was in a volunteer organization called the North Carolina State Guard Association. Now, do not confuse that with the National Guard. It is a volunteer organization that assists the citizens of North Carolina in the event of an emergency. They have no state or national sanctions, but most of their group have served in the military or fire department before their retirement. Kevin Randall discovered this in his investigation, but he also made a little tiny mistake when he stated that he could only find a one-page website for the North Carolina National Guard Association, because if he had gone one level lower, he would have discovered they have a very nice multiple-page website showing what they have done, who they are, and what they are planning to do. But the bottom line is this. Stephen Lufkin can lay claim to the rank of Brigadier General because that is the rank he wore during his time with the NCSGA. But it was not a rank given or awarded to him by any official military organization. It would be similar to me joining a group that reenacts Roman military operations and laying claim to the rank of centurion or legate. Stephen Greer launched a vicious attack against Kevin Randall in an effort to defend Stephen Lufkin's claim to being a Brigadier General. But when all the smoke and mirrors are cleared away, it is obvious that the claim is not entirely what it appeared to be. And unfortunately, it has to make one wonder if everything else that Stephen Lufkin lays claim to is all that it appears to be. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Vermont, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
Of course, then you have to wonder, Dave Furlott, if the NCSGA consists of old brigadier generals.
Well, actually, it doesn't. I checked at their cited detail.
Yes.
And they have, there's colonels, and there are a couple of generals, and a few others, and then there's captains, and then I believe there was a lieutenant or two there.
Are there any other ranks there?
Not that I noticed.
Ah.
Yeah, they're...
They're just an elitist officer corps association is what is the insinuation, yeah?
Well, I don't know. They actually seem like, in all honesty, the group seems like they do a good job.
Yeah, I'm sure they do, and I'm just being stupid. Because that's a radio host's job sometimes is to be stupid.
But the nice thing about them, too, because the one thing that also worried me was I was afraid I was going to discover they were some, like, white supremacist group or something, but they're not.
Yeah.
They seem to be a very nice group of guys that are there, or guys and gals, who go out and help people. You know, they helped out during Hurricane Rita or something in 2001.
Yeah. So the bottom line is that Lufkin was the equivalent of a sergeant or something in his time at the White House.
Yeah.
And not a brigadier general who might have been privy to a lot more.
Yeah. For some of the stuff that he's claiming, it's kind of unlikely that an enlisted man would be privy to some of this stuff.
Yeah.
And to say that he had the ear of the president at the time, I don't know.
Maybe stretching it a bit.
It could be.
Maybe the president saw something he may have typed out in the way of a communique.
Could be.
Yeah. Dave Frelott, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you next week.
For sure.
Good night, Dave.
Good night.
One of my favorite cryptozoologists on the planet, and I know precisely, I think, two, but a man who has been on the radio here out of Toronto several times with me, Lorne Coleman, a cryptozoologist, joins us. Good evening, Lorne.
Good evening. How are you doing there in Toronto?
Well, we're cold, but we're happy with the medal standings.
Oh, I guess you are.
Yeah, it's
kind of cold over here in Maine too. So.
Yeah, I guess so, and kind of windy too, I understand, huh?
Oh yeah, we're having some 50 mile an hour gusts. So.
Oh, nice. Cryptozoology, the study of hidden animals, including Bigfoot, Loch Ness monsters, Yeti, Mayaka, the skunk ape, and hundreds of other cryptids. I guess you would include chupacabras in there somewhere, eh, Lauren?
I think I would, because I think that underneath some of these fantastic creatures that we hear about for a few years, there's something that may be beneath all of that smoke. And chupacabras, Mothman, Jersey Devil, whatever the crazy names are underneath them, there may be a real animal there.
Now, the chupacabra specifically is some sort of strange creature that has popped up mostly across South America, although there have been reports out of Florida and some out of Texas.
Yeah, it really came about in 1995 out of Puerto Rico when there was some livestock that was mutilated, and the whole name chupacabra actually means goat sucker. So they found some goats and other livestock with the blood drained from them and related this to a little 3.5-4 foot tall creature with spiky hair that would go around on it bipedally with three toes and three claws on its hands. And that was rather unusual. And then, as you say, it spread to most of the Hispanic areas of North America and South America.
Now, somehow this has gotten tied into UFOs and UFO occupants at some point. Do you know where that connection was made?
Yeah, I think it happened very early on, because in South America and Central America, you didn't have cryptozoologists on the ground. You had a fair body of very sophisticated ufologists, and so they were the first ones that got involved in some of the chupacabras investigations and naturally made the connection between UFOs. Then in Brazil, there's this whole sort of twilight zone between UFO creatures and the chupacabras, and in fact whether or not the Brazilian government has captured one, and is it a hidden phenomenon, in other words hidden from the public front by a conspiracy in the government. And so it got kind of all messed around in that.
That presumably is tied into the Varginha case too, huh?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's the one. Yep.
And what was interesting about that one was not only supposedly had they captured one of these creatures, but at least one, if not more, members of the military died as a result of coming into contact with one of these creatures.
Yep. And there's always around the edges of whether or not there's some curses or is there any toxicity with some of these creatures? What we know from chupacabras, though, and as far as Puerto Rico, that actually those cases really probably go back to the 1970s, and it's only the media attention in 1995 that really made it an explosive crossover to the Anglo culture, and a lot of Americans, North Americans, started noticing it.
Mm. You've been interested in the connection. I guess it's the Mothman death chain that continues, and I'm not sure that that's the right expression to use, but the strange deaths that have happened, or the synchronistic deaths, or the coincidental deaths that have happened around the Mothman story out of Point Pleasant in Pennsylvania, yeah.
We know, of course, in 1966 and 1967, we had the wave of Mothman sightings in Ohio and then in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. And what I started noticing after the movie came out this what I call the Mothman death list or death curse, a real connection between individuals that were tightly woven with the original case as well as the movie. And on my website, it's up to 84 names.
Oh.
And some of the more spectacular ones is, and I did an analysis. A lot of people said, well, you know, obviously people are going to die someday anyway when they get old. But a lot of these people are deaths like, you know, the 49-year-old special effects coordinator of the movie that dies or the executive producer. And the one that really kind of sent waves through Hollywood was last in July of 2004, the 42-year-old wife of the director of the Mothman Prophecies movie died very mysteriously, very quietly in that summer. And he actually, the new movie that's out, Firewall, he was supposed to be the director of that, and he resigned from directing that because of the death of his wife. So those kinds of deaths, very directly connected to people that worked on the movie. The week that the movie came out in 2002, January of 2002, several relatives of eyewitnesses to the Mothman in the 60s actually died, and the largest number of people in fatal automobile accidents happened that week in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. So it's something that, you know, not exactly cryptozoology, but it's certainly something that I've been watching and noticing, that the Mothman, which was really probably just some big birds that were seen, which would cryptozoologically be interesting, but there's this sinister nature to Mothman that we can't really ignore.
An email here, he says, I haven't read Lauren's Mothman book yet, but I love the Keel book and Jerry Clark's account in the UFO Encyclopedia. Could you ask Lauren to describe his take on the John Keel account? The really weird stuff had little to do with Mothman. It was everything else.
Well, for my Mothman book, and John and I have known each other for, you know, 30-some years, I interviewed him, and John is very, very open to the fact that he's not a ufologist. He says, I'm a demonologist, I'm an occultist. So when he wrote his book, The Mothman Prophecies, he wrote it like he was writing a novel, in which he mixed in Men in Black, UFOs, cattle mutilations, the Mothman, including, you know, contactees and different entities that were talking to him in New York. So when they made the movie, and in fact when you read that book, you can see that you get very confused where you're at.
I noticed that myself.
He switches where the action is on purpose, because to John it was all interrelated. And I love John Keel, but he in fact really has clouded the whole Mothman story for years, because what he's done is, it's just like you put it into John Keel's blender, and it mixes up things so much that one of the things that I really wanted to do in my book, Mothman and Other Curious Encounters, was to separate the cryptozoology from the Keelian sort of spawn, as I called it. And you know, there's room for Keel and his interest, and it's very exciting. I loved his books, and I like the guy. But you really, if you want to go into a cryptozoology, those people probably saw some large unknown birds, and then everything else got mixed up. And in fact, talking to some of the witnesses who went into really psychological post-traumatic stress syndrome, many times it was because they talked to John Keel. And one witness told me that, you know, after John Keel came there and scared her to death, she put a cross on every wall in her apartment. You know, you just have to be careful with witnesses sometimes.
Yeah. Yes. And it's really easy to lead witnesses who are easily led in the state that they're in when they've seen something they can't explain.
Exactly.
LaurenColeman.com is the website, LOREN, C-O-L-E-M-A-N, laurencoleman.com. And when you do a search for Lauren Coleman's name at amazon.com, I think the number of books that they list by Lauren Coleman stops at 29, but there's probably 29 others that he's also written on various subjects. And his latest is an interesting, teamed up with Jerome Clark, a well-known UFO historian and a frequent guest on this program, and certainly a contributor to the UFO Updates email list. The title actually is intriguing, Lauren Coleman, The Unidentified Creatures of the Outer Edge. Is that a crossover between UFOs and cryptozoological critters?
Well, the subtitle of the work really explains it's the early works of Jerome Clark and Lauren Coleman. And in 1975, Jerry and I wrote a book called The Unidentified, looking at fairy folklores, religious visions, airship stories in terms of an answer to the phenomena.
Uh-huh.
And then in 1978, we wrote a book, Creatures of the Outer Edge, about the cryptozoological answers. And these are two books that Jerry and I have just been happy to leave on the shelf because they were part of and kicked off the psychological movement in ufology. Mm-hmm. And some of the early thoughts there, because they were based on our toying with Jungian thought. But we decided, 30 years later, we're going to take these books, a lot of good case materials in these books, and we wrote a whole new introduction that where we explain what we were thinking and kind of tried to distance ourselves from the theory but not the data.
Uh-huh.
And so people, have told us that they're buying Creatures of the Outer Edge for $150 on eBay.
Whoa.
So we thought, here's a book under $20 in which people can get a book for that's over 500 words. 500 pages and two books in one. So that's what this new book is. It's a double edition of a very old, our two first old books.
Well, in what has become the tradition of mashing things together.
Yes.
The Unidentified Creatures of the Outer Edge by our guest Lauren Coleman and Jerome Clark. Lauren, a brief time together, but we touched on the things that I needed to touch on, and thank you for responding to Corey Cameron's question about Mothman on the list this week. It was good of you. Thanks.
Sure, you're welcome.
And look forward to talking to you again. Maybe what we'll do in a couple of 3 weeks is we'll have both you and Jerry on, and we'll get into some of the psychology of your current book together.
Sure, that would be fine. That would be great.
Thanks, Lauren.
Okay, it's nice talking to you tonight.
Good talking with you, too. The Unidentified Creatures of the Outer Edge. Go look at Lauren's website. It's fascinating stuff. LaurenColeman.com, LaurenColeman, LaurenColeman.com. Robert Hastings has devoted countless hours researching UFOs and the United States government's covert response to them. He's spoken at over 500 colleges and universities since 1981 in an effort to bring to the public the intriguing information that he and other researchers have obtained. From 1988 to 2002, Robert was employed as a laboratory analyst by Philips Semiconductors in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's now semi-retired and lives in Surfside Beach, South Carolina. And we welcome Robert Hastings to Strange Days Indeed. Good evening, Robert.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you along. My, you have put in an astounding amount of work on this the subject of UFOs and nukes, as it was called on the UFO updates list. UFO sightings at ICBM sites and nuclear weapons storage areas, as it's called on the NICAP site. And I printed out that report of yours, and I think it's probably around 10 point. It's 23 pages. It's a lot of testimony is what it is. What were you doing back in 1967 that got you interested in UFOs, Robert Hastings?
My father was in the Air Force for 20 years. His last assignment was at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana. Coincidentally, in 1967, as many of your listeners undoubtedly know, there were a number of incidents involving UFO sightings at nuclear missile silos, launch control facilities or launch facilities. I happened to be a junior in high school at the time. However, I had a job as a janitor three nights a week in the base air traffic control tower. One of the rooms that I routinely cleaned was what's called RAPCON, a radar approach control, where FAA and Air Force radar personnel would guide in jets, so aircraft of all types, into the base. And long story short, I just happened to witness being in the right place at the right time. Five blips, five targets on radar one evening, very briefly, that the FAA controller who pointed them out to me referred to as UFOs or some similar term. I subsequently brought this up with my father, and he made inquiries at the base. Initially, he was told by persons with whom he worked that these were Soviet surveillance aircraft, which didn't seem plausible to me for a variety of reasons. However, shortly thereafter, off the record, my father told me briefly that indeed other inquiries had been made and these were considered to be bona fide UFOs. Not only that, but they were maneuvering near nuclear missile silos at a place called Judith Basin. So that sparked my interest in the subject. Again, I was only 16, almost 17 at the time, but by the time I was in my early 20s, I began to take an active interest in researching this and began, just one person at a time, began interviewing former and retired Air Force personnel regarding UFO incidents in general, but nuclear weapons-related cases in particular.
Wow, it's a remarkable dossier. I mean, the number of people that you actually managed to track down. To go back to that incident in 1967, were you ever debriefed or told not to talk about it, or was your father lent on to get you not to talk about it?
Well, again, I was simply a custodian. I had made, I wouldn't say he was a friend, but I certainly had ingratiated myself with one of the FAA controllers. I have a curious mind. I asked him a number of questions in the months that I worked there about about radar, how it worked, how they operated on a day-to-day business. Of course, I was asking these questions when he was not at work at the consoles, but in the break room and at other times when he was not on duty. And this gentleman graciously offered his time and answered all of my questions about radar theory and operation. And he was the person who briefly called me over one night while I was in there cleaning. Again, I was a junior in high school, and just briefly made a couple of off-the-cuff statements about these were UFOs. There were five targets. He did say that jet aircraft were launched to investigate it. And then within a matter of, I would say, a minute or two, his manner suddenly became much more businesslike, and I was asked to come back and clean the room later. When I approached him about that discussion or the incident a few days later, he was not at all interested in talking about it and abruptly changed the subject. So, no, I was not debriefed. That was the nature of my exposure to it all. My father got all of the information that he did on an informal basis. He was not directly in the loop, so to speak. But he worked in what was called the SAGE building. It was a very sophisticated computer-driven radar system that the Air Force had in operation at the time. He had a number of acquaintances, colleagues, working both in radar and other types of related activities. And as best as I can determine, he simply, there was a lot of talk going around at work, and he was in on some of the discussions and subsequently told me just a very, very small bit of what he himself had heard. So that was the extent of the interest or the exposure to the incident at the time.
And there was no further discussion about UFOs with the FAA traffic guy after that?
Oh, not on my part. As I said, the gentleman was quite obviously not willing to pursue the conversation further, and I don't know if when I left the room, I don't know if things had developed in such a way that he felt that he had already said too much. I have no way of evaluating what went on except to say that whereas he was somewhat open with what he was telling me initially. That was as far as he was prepared to take it. Now,
so in your subsequent investigations as you grew up, did you come across any other related to that date witnesses?
Well, I suspect that a number of your listeners know about the UFO incidents in March of 1967 at Malmstrom Air Force Base. There is an article on the web, an excellent article called The Malmstrom Air Force Base UFO Missile Incident.
Mm-hmm.
It's co-authored by a former Air Force missile launch officer named Robert Salas, Bob Salas.
We've had him on the program, yes.
He's one of my heroes and a good friend. The author is co-written by a researcher named Jim Klotz, who I consider to be a good friend as well.
Yes.
I know through their research, I know through subsequent conversations I've had with persons that appear in my article, for those of you listening who would like to read the article, it is on the NICAP.org website. That site is hosted by or is coordinated by Fran Ridge. It's an excellent source of information on UFOs and in particular nuclear weapons-related material. There is an extensive discussion on the part of 20-some of my sources about this type of material. But it became very obvious to me by the early 70s that what I witnessed and what my father was told was certainly not an isolated incident. I have never been able to pin down with any degree of certainty the time frame coincides. For reasons that I won't go into, I have reconstructed my experience to be somewhere in the month of March, probably mid to late March 67, and that is precisely when the event that Bob Salas describes occurred, and other sources whom I've included in my article have described numerous sightings of UFOs at nuclear missile sites in the month of March, including late March of 67.
Our guest this hour is Robert Hastings, who has compiled a remarkable list of witness testimony, witnesses, military, mostly Air Force, crews at ICBM sites and nuclear weapons storage areas around the United States. And you have to bear in mind, as we said when Robert Salas was on this program a few months ago, that these people are psychologically vetted, trained, screened to do the jobs that they were in place to do, to man and possibly fire nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles. These are not Okies from Muskogee, as a lot of debunkers, members of PSYCOP would have you believe. These are credible witnesses who reported all kinds of strange things going on at these missile silos, including complete flights of missiles somehow being shut down, knocked out of action, or countdowns started on them, and these guys freaking the crews there, trying to stop the countdowns on these nuclear-tipped weapons. Robert Hastings, just looking very briefly through a lot of this witness testimony, it makes what little of my hair is left on top of my head curl. That, you know, these weapons would be in place to defend the continental United States, and yet somehow would get shut down by strange objects hovering over the bases.
Well, that's the big story. As I mentioned in the article, and others certainly have mentioned before me, including Bob Salas, it's not a question of mere surveillance that went on. On occasion, based on the witness's own testimony, and I'm talking about missile launch officers and missile maintenance personnel, the missiles actually malfunctioned precisely when security personnel were reporting saucer-shaped objects in their vicinity. Bob Sells himself was involved in one such incident. Within a few days, they thought initially on the same day, but now they think it was probably a few days earlier. An identical event occurred at another launch control facility. An entire flight, as it's called, of 10 nuclear missiles simultaneously malfunctioned precisely when security personnel were reporting saucer-shaped objects in their vicinity. So some rather spooky things have taken place. In the article that I have online now, I have references at another Air Force base in Wyoming called F.E. Warren Air Force Base near Cheyenne, where a former launch officer named Walter Billings has talked about a nearly identical event, three events actually, one of which apparently resulted in, at least he heard rumors to the effect, among the launch personnel and missile maintenance personnel, that the targeting codes, the actual programming of the missiles' warheads, had been erased shortly after a UFO was sighted in the vicinity of the missile in question. And again, as you pointed out, these are not kooks. These are not just Joe Blow off the street. These persons are rigorously trained and evaluated psychologically and otherwise to be responsible, to be given the responsibility of launching nuclear missiles in time of war. And yet, slowly but surely, after years and even decades, one by one, these persons are coming forward and talking about incidents involving UFOs, certainly flying around the missiles, and on occasion even apparently tampering with the missiles. So this is quite some extraordinary information in my view.
And the interesting thing about the Warren case is that around 1:30 in the morning, you say Captain Snelling of the U.S. Air Force Command Post near Cheyenne, Wyoming, called to say that 15 to 20 phone calls had been received at the local radio station about a large circular object emitting several colors but no sound sighted over the city.
That was actually part of another incident on August 1st, 1965, and I've actually included a verbatim copy of a memorandum that the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek released to the public. He was Project Blue Book's consultant, scientific consultant. He actually released this very detailed memorandum relating to multiple UFO sightings at F.E. Warren's missile sites, but again, that was 1965. The other incident that I referred to, in which Walter Billings, the launch officer, was involved or was aware of from hearing radio chatter, was in the fall of 1973. I include yet a third instance in 1981 timeframe in my article, in which another Air Force security policeman is talking about multiple sightings of UFOs or strange lights, unauthorized lights, hovering over the base weapons storage area where nuclear missile warheads are stored. So one of the things that I think many people who are even familiar with the Malmstrom Air Force Base sightings from 1967 are unaware of or don't appreciate is that these incidents have not been isolated to one year or another. They've gone on almost on a continuous basis since the early 1960s, even to the mid-90s. The latest incidents that have been described to me by former and retired Air Force personnel occurred in the mid-1990s. So this was certainly not something that happened once or twice over a 30 or 40-year period.
So ongoing observation, ongoing tampering by whomever or whatever these circular disks are manned by.
Correct.
Amazing story. And presumably this is still going on now, though who would report it right now, I don't know. As you say, up until the mid-1990s.
Well, in my opinion, yes, it's probably gone on within the last 12 months, but proving that is something else altogether. One must keep in mind that active duty Air Force personnel are risking their career at the very least by talking publicly with somebody like me or the media about these things. So I have made it a practice over the years never to approach active duty Air Force personnel. I always seek out persons who I know were in the Air Force either as a career or got out after some period of time. But I don't really want to jeopardize anybody's career, per se.
Dave Furlot, who was on the program a little earlier this evening, has called. Dave Robert is a regular weekly editorialist on this program. Dave.
It's rather interesting that our infamous Project Blue Book, the statement was, UFOs pose no threat to national security. The final findings.
Yeah.
It kind of flies in the face of that real nicely with this kind of stuff. Excellent job, Robert.
Thank you very much.
It is interesting that those words just do echo on and on and on, don't they? When they closed Project Blue Book down, which was the United States Air Force team that supposedly looked into UFO reports, 27% of which they could not explain, by the way. The closing words were UFOs pose no threat to United States security. However, as we have heard Robert Hastings say and Robert Salas and several other people on this program, it seems that UFOs most certainly did pose, if not still do so, security threats to the United States and other countries around the world.
Big time. If they're able to shut down missile launches and shut down full flights of missiles, we have to be very concerned.
Well, if I can chime in here on a couple of things. First,
please,
of all,
yes.
I think it's been fairly well established. Years ago, a memo surfaced from a General Bullender in which he talked about the fact that Blue Book did not routinely receive national security related cases. So there was a little bit of sleight of hand going on all along. I would add also that my sources, many of my sources, certainly not all of them, have referred to debriefings by OSI, Office of Special Investigations Agents. It's a group within the Air Force that, according to my sources, have been involved on an ongoing basis with debriefing UFO witnesses. About 20 years ago, maybe more, I attempted to access some documents from OSI via the Freedom of Information Act and was informed that all documents relating to UFOs had been declassified. And according to the person who responded to my request, they had no further documents in their possession relating to these incidents. In my estimate, that simply was not a forthright response. All of the witnesses that I've interviewed have repeatedly talked about OSI, no other group, just OSI being involved in the interrogations, the debriefings. So I think a wealth of information certainly was gathered by that group. Where it is, God knows. As far as the national security aspects to all of this, I have to tell you that, remember that I come from a military background. Not only was my father in the Air Force for 20 years, but my grandfather was in the Army for over 30. I myself have this tendency to talk back and ask questions, so I chose not to follow in their footsteps. But in any event, I am of the opinion that it has to be remembered that there are some legitimate national security considerations involved in all of this. You know, if I were in the Pentagon and the CIA and the White House and I was concerned about, let's suppose that even if whoever's flying UFOs are not hostile per se, the mere fact that they're here and able to shut down our nuclear weapons and, in fact, maybe from another world or several other worlds is something that would have possibly unpredictable repercussions if all of that were openly and freely acknowledged to not only the American public but the world. So this is not something that should be treated lightly, in my view. Obviously, because I do what I do, and I have spoken out on the lecture circuit for 25 years about the reality of all of this, I am of the opinion that, yes, the public does deserve to have the facts. And this is simply they're postponing the inevitable by not announcing the facts. But at the same time, I don't think this is the type of cover-up like Watergate where there were self-serving political interests. I think the people in the Pentagon and the CIA are doing what they consider to be the best course of action. I obviously disagree, and millions of other people in the U.S. and around the world disagree as well. But I don't think it's a black and white issue.
Well, it's interesting that Cordy Bryant, who had covered the MIT abduction conference as a skeptical journalist, had said at one point, and I know I have a recording of it somewhere, that if he were the Secretary of the Air Force and these things were flying out of his airspace and there was nothing he could do about it, he would deny that they existed.
Well, exactly. And I think it may have been Bud Hopkins, but somebody has said, you know, what do you do if you're the president? You go on television and say they're real, they're from another world, and they're so ahead of us that let's hope they're not hostile because we can't do a damn thing about it if they are. I mean, that's not something you can say to a national or an international audience. So it's a very sticky situation.
It is. It's a very sticky situation, but I'm sure that most people out there, although, you know, maybe I'm not right about it, but most people out there would rather know the truth than not.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And an email, Robert, from Bubba. He says, I assume that Robert has lived his whole life in South Carolina. I wonder, has he come across or researched any Carolina area sightings?
Actually, as an Air Force brat, I've lived all over the U.S. and in Europe. Most of my adult life I've lived in the state of New Mexico. I've just recently moved back to South Carolina. I lived here about 20 years ago.
Hmm.
I'm really unfamiliar with what's going on here locally, except to say that there have been reports both in the early 80s when I lived here briefly and again within the last year or two of sightings of UFOs off the coast, just off the Myrtle Beach coast. And so those sightings do make the news, but I haven't really pursued them, to be honest with you.
Okay, and thank you, Bubba, for that email. Robert, of all the reports that you've amassed, which one left you with your mouth hanging open?
I've frequently asked that, and it's really difficult to pin it down to a single case. I would say perhaps the so-called Big Sur case. For those of you who are not familiar with that, two former Air Force officers, a then-Lieutenant Bob Jacobs and a then-Major Florenz Mansman, have independently gone on the record saying that an Atlas missile was test-launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in September of 1964. It was an experimental design for a warhead system, and according to Bob Jacobs, who was the head of the photographic unit filming the launch, according to Jacobs, and this has been confirmed repeatedly by Major Mansman, they actually picked up a UFO on film, a saucer-shaped object with a dome structure, coming into film frame, camera frame, circling the warhead, flashing four bright flashes of light at the warhead, whereupon the dummy warhead tumbled into the Pacific Ocean. This was a test launch, once again, in the fall of 64. Now, I have private correspondence between Mansman and Jacobs. I have correspondence, private letters that Major Mansman wrote to other individuals 20 years ago, but 20 years after the event, and they are just marveling in these letters as to the amazing nature of the incident. So I believe it happened as they've described. I think it was nothing less than a warning shot, so to speak. Bob Jacobs, Lieutenant Jacobs, in one of his letters to Major Mansman makes the statement, and I'm paraphrasing, but this is pretty close, I think someone just fired a shot across the bow of our nuclear silliness ship. And I think it couldn't be said better. I think that's precisely what occurred. And I think the business with the missiles being shut down at Malmstrom and Warren Air Force Base and these other places, I think somebody's demonstrating that, first of all, they have the ability to shut down these missiles if they wish. And more to the point, I think that somebody, in effect, is wagging a finger at us, in effect telling us that we're playing with fire, that nuclear weapons may, in fact, be the end of mankind if we don't come to our senses. And so that's my hypothesis as to what is going on. That sentiment, by the way, is shared by many, if not most, of my sources, persons who were involved in the incidents in one fashion or another. Now, none of them were ever told, and not one of them got any feedback as to what persons at higher levels of command concluded about the incidents. That's not how it works. This information is so extremely sensitive. People in the field are debriefed. That information is kicked up the chain of command, and no one who is involved in these incidents ever gets any feedback as to what assessment has been made at the Pentagon, for example. But the person's opinion, their own opinion as to what they witnessed was in effect, somebody was in effect telling us that we're playing with fire.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? And particularly in view of what you hear from the abductees who are being told the same thing, basically, that we're destroying our planet and we need to take care of things here very quickly. And Bob Jacobs, we've also had on the program, and in fact, Bob's voice is in the opening of this program every week, describing what you described as the disc-shaped object flying around the warhead and firing some sort of ray at it or some sort of light at it, and it falls out of the sky.
That's correct. Yeah. And again, what struck me in these private letters, I mean, these were letters that only one or two individuals would see, correspondence between Jacobs and Mansman, and they are just, 20 years after the fact, are still obviously still staggered by what took place, and they are speaking of it to each other in very real concrete terms. This is nothing that was going to be publicized or for media coverage or anything, and among themselves, between mm-hmm. themselves, they were certainly stunned by what they were privy to.
Yeah, really amazing. Are you continuing with this research? You said earlier you make it a point of not approaching serving people in the Air Force who are still manning these nuclear missile sites.
Oh, it's a daily occurrence for me. When I am speaking at colleges and universities, if I'm approached by persons who are in the military with something to tell me, then I try to glean information from persons such as that. Of course, I don't accept every story that I'm provided with. I do background checks on the sources to establish, first of all, whether they were at the bases they claimed they were at, and so on. I try to evaluate as best as possible my sense of their veracity, whether they're trying to pull my leg or overly imaginative. So once I weeded out sort of those outliers, I'm left with what I consider to be excellent sources.
Mm-hmm.
In my article, I talk about incidents at Walker Air Force Base, which, by the way, is in Roswell, New Mexico. And there were a number of incidents involving UFOs hovering over the Atlas missile silos there in the early 60s. I have now seven sources, I believe it is, six or seven sources who've independently talked about those incidents. One of them is a retired lieutenant colonel named Philip Moore, who's quite adamant and quite open and quite matter-of-fact about the reality of these incidents. Independently, sources are coming from all over the country. We're at various bases in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and they're all essentially telling the same story. And I think it's a remarkable story, certainly.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the 1947 incident in Roswell was at Roswell Army Air Force Field there, and that was where the bombs were dropped on Japan.
More precisely, it was where the 509th Bomber mm-hmm. Squadron was based.
It was based, exactly.
Which was the group that earlier, yes, dropped the bombs on Japan. It was, as has been pointed out, at that time in 1947, it was the only atomic bomber base in the world. And so again, if in that respect, if indeed the object that crashed near Roswell was in fact an extraterrestrial craft, and that's my opinion.
Mm.
I'm certainly not an expert on that case, but I believe that that's what occurred. And so again, you have this nuclear weapons connection.
And the nuclear testing at White Sands was observed, apparently. It just goes on and on and on. And as Stanton T. Friedman says, when that first bomb was tested, it made a lot of other races in the universe sit up and pay attention. It was these people and that blue marble over there could potentially be dangerous to us.
Well, it's hard to really, in my view, it's hard to get bottom line answers. The old cliche, there are far more questions than there are answers at this point. I'm of the opinion that there's more than one race involved. They're from various places in our galaxy, perhaps even farther. There's now some very intriguing developments in theoretical physics involving potentially theories that would account for, would permit rather, faster than light travel, which traditionally scientists said is the great barrier, even if there are intelligent races out there. The distances between solar systems are so vast that if they're traveling sublight speed, they simply can't get around space to and from. But there's Dr. Michio Kaku.
I was about to bring his name up. Yes, yes.
So I think what's going on is something that our physicists are just now getting a taste of and getting a sense of. And in my view, whatever has been going on in our era since the 40s has probably gone on much longer. It's difficult to pin down, to prove, to verify what's gone on even recently, let alone 100 or 500 or 1,000 years ago. But I suspect this has been going on for quite some time. But I am of the opinion that the fact that the heightened level of UFO activity in the last 50 years coincides precisely with the invention and testing and deployment and threatened use of nuclear weapons, and there are so many cases now coming forward, coming to light, where these objects are obviously interested in our nuclear weapons, that I think it's not a coincidence. I think there's definitely something that's going on here that's a link.
Robert L. Hastings, the author of UFO Sightings at ICBM Sites and Nuclear Weapons Storage Areas. You can go read his long article, full of and riveting testimony, at NICAP.org. Probably easier if you're online to go to tonight's program listing at virtuallystrange.net and click the UFOs and nukes link. Robert, thank you, sir, for your work and for being with us tonight, and I'm glad it's you that put all of this together.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
It's certainly a labor of love and a labor of intrigue. Good night, Robert Hastings.
Good night. Thank you again.
Good night, and thank you again. And there's also an interesting link to an article at tonight's program listing. Not going to have time to hit on it too hard. Top five stars that may support life announced. This is from National Geographic News. In an atmosphere of looming federal funding cuts, the search for intelligent life on other planets is still capturing the imagination and research interest of astronomers. And a woman astronomer has listed five possible stars that are nearby, three that can be seen with a naked eye, that there might be life on planets that surround those stars like our sun. That's tonight. That's this week. Next week, Nick Redfern will join us to discuss his latest book. We'll see you then. Good night, Big Daddy. Good night, Mom, Jim Pacheco. We'll see you next week.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Dean Mascardelli.